Welcome to the AFP Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Wednesday, November 23rd, 2022. This is the 28th edition of the AFP Report, a podcast series where I will be interviewing reporters and contributors to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, as well as other special guests. Please consider subscribing to American Free Press if you are not already. Details can be found at AmericanFreePress.net. And today I'm joined by Dr. Kevin Barrett, a leading voice in the alternative media and a regular columnist for American Free Press. All right, Dr. Kevin Barrett, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing, John?
Good. I'm just fine. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me once again. We just wrapped up issue 49 and 50 of American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and it is being sent over to the printer as we speak. We had a short week this week due to the Thanksgiving holiday, and I would like to start off by, of course, wishing all our listeners and you, sir, a very happy Thanksgiving holiday. Also, for anyone listening that is not a subscriber to American Free Press, please do consider picking up a subscription, and those details can be found at our website, AmericanFreePress.net. AFP truly is the last real newspaper still publishing a print edition in the United States, something that most even mainstream big corporate newspapers can't say today. Mostly everything is digital nowadays, but AFP still has a print edition, and it's something that I think is frankly a remarkable feat considering the market these days. So anyways, I just wanted to encourage everybody to support the publication with a subscription. And Dr. Barrett, you, of course, are one of the leading voices in the alternative media. You have been writing and contributing to American Free Press for quite a while now. And I want to start off by discussing our front page article in this current issue, which sort of relates to the front page article in our previous edition that focused on the 2022 midterm elections. And in that previous edition, issue 47 and 48, which was mailed out almost 2 weeks ago now, I wrote a piece highlighting all of the money pumped into the 2022 election cycle, where big donors and plutocrats funneled billions of dollars into both federal and state elections this current election cycle. Unsurprisingly, George Soros was the top individual donor to federal elections, and the bulk of his money went to Democrats and other far-left causes, as we well know at this point. Sam Bankman-Fried, the Jewish criminal who owned and managed FTX into bankruptcy, fleecing billions of dollars of customer and investor money in the process, was also a top donor this current cycle. In 2022, Bankman-Fried was a top donor to the Biden campaign, which I'm sure most people are aware of at this point. I wanted to just briefly read something really quick out of that article in the previous edition that's focusing on elections and the money involved in elections. So I mentioned George Soros was the top donor. He spent $128 million over the course of 2022, which is, I mean, just an astronomical sum of money. Other top donors this current election cycle included Richard Uihlein and his wife Elizabeth, a billionaire family who founded and own Uihlein, the nation's largest shipping supply firm. Uihlein spent roughly $80 million in 2022, nearly $50 million less than Soros. Kenneth Griffin, founder and CEO of Citadel, a top hedge fund worth billions of dollars, spent over $68 million, while Jeffrey Yass, who helped found Susquehanna International Group, a major financial and technology firm, spent over $47 million. Timothy Mellon, an heir to the Mellon banking fortune, spent just over $40 million. And Sam Bankman-Fried, a 30-year-old investor currently in major financial trouble with his cryptocurrency exchange FTX, spent over $39 million. Many of these actually supported GOP candidates, surprisingly. According to Open Secrets, the top 25 donors in this current election cycle all spent over $11 million in this current cycle. And I'm just curious, I mean, just to kind of start this conversation, how are average Americans supposed to compete with these plutocrats and well-financed and organized lobbying groups that have a total stranglehold over our so-called democracy in America?
Well, these so-called campaign contributions are really just bribes. And it's a euphemism to call them campaign contributions. And obviously, the system cannot work properly when the whole political system is being funded by these extremely wealthy players. It's a sort of like if the NFL had a system where the players and the coaches and the teams could elect the referees or give them money to pay the referees' salaries and bribe them. And there was no limit whatsoever to these bribes. And we already have people complaining a little bit about questionable calls of defensive holding and things like that. Just imagine how that would be if the system was that the referees who were supposed to impartially enforce the rules subsisted entirely on bribe money from the people playing the game. It's completely ridiculous. So there's just no way you could possibly have a functioning, honest system in those circumstances. But what are we going to do at this point? The Supreme Court has said that there is an unlimited right of free speech of billionaires to bribe elected officials. So we're stuck with that unless we have something equivalent to a revolution. And
Right.
as Jesse Ventura said, don't start the revolution without me.
Yeah, now you're referring to that. It was the Citizens United case, right? That I think
That's right.
basically opened the doors for big money to come in and really, spend as much money. And you're right, it is basically an investment. It's a bribe for these corrupt politicians that they take. And they are certainly not working, at least the vast majority of them, they're certainly not working in the interests of the American people. And frankly, I mean, I have very little faith in the integrity of American elections, especially after the 2020 fiasco, where the election was, I mean, in my view anyways, just blatantly rigged against former President Trump, who I am not a fan of. I mean, I supported President Trump in 2016 and even voted for him in 2020, but I mean, I'm not like a diehard, blind loyal fan of President Trump by any means. But still, I think there's no way that Joe Biden received over 81 million legitimate votes in that election. And I frankly have a hard time believing Democrats won in some of the key races in this current 2022 midterm election. It looks like the GOP is going to wind up with a very slim majority in the House, while the Senate is basically still deadlocked. And I know there's a runoff election in Georgia upcoming between the incumbent Democrat Senator Ralph Warnock and the Republican challenger Herschel Walker, who I haven't followed that campaign that closely, but I have not been very impressed with Herschel Walker by any means. So I don't know. It's kind of just more of the same in my view anyways. And I'm curious what do you think about the election, and what can Americans expect in the new Congress? Will anything actually change substantially in your view?
I don't see any major changes coming. We're still a kind of a fake democracy, and we're actually an oligarchy, and the richest people in this oligarchy are plundering more and more of the wealth and taking it away from ordinary hardworking people and changing the system to benefit themselves. And of course, their end game is to get rid of most people and have a few human slaves left, and then lots of automated robotic slaves to help them enjoy their domination of the earth. I mean, that's kind of the whole intention, really, of these people working for the Great Reset, and the kind of transhumanist future that they have in store for us. So I think we really do need to find a way to stop that historical trajectory. And my greatest hope really is that some catastrophe, probably a combination of military defeat and economic collapse, will wake up the American people and stimulate them to finally get up off their butts and do something about the way the country's been stolen from them. But nothing's going to change with the rules the way they are, with the current oligarchs ruling the way they do right now.
Right. Well, that collapse may be coming in the years ahead as the situation in Ukraine continues to favor the Russians, it seems like, anyways. I know the conflict is still kind of dragging out, but I just don't see how Ukraine could ever regain any of that territory unless, you know, NATO and the U.S. actually got involved militarily, which may happen, you know, given the warmongering psychopaths controlling Washington, D.C. So we'll see what happens. But it seems like the American empire is certainly on decline, and you see signs of that everywhere you go across this country, in every big city, even small towns. You're seeing homeless people, you're seeing economic destitution, you know, people struggling, inflation's at an all-time high. And see, that's what really is very suspicious in my mind, you know, heading into this election. I mean, the Democrats and the Biden administration in particular were so unpopular. I mean, everybody basically saw through this totally fraudulent administration and just the totally, you know, far left woke politics and agenda that they were promoting. I mean, President Biden is up there giving speeches basically condemning as domestic terrorists over half the country. And, you know, this is a man that's supposed to lead and unite the country and, you know, overcome political obstacles. And that's just not the case at all. I mean, this is a totally weaponized justice system, a weaponized Department of Justice. And, you know, we have open borders. I mean, I could go on. The country is a total mess. So I have a hard time believing that the Democrats did so well in this current election. And not to mention, it totally broke with historic norms, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, usually the incumbent party does very poorly in the midterm election, right? And that didn't really happen at all this cycle, which is very suspicious in my mind.
Yeah, I agree. There's been a very suspicious trend for whatever results would please the oligarchs the most and the national security state, which is the sort of mafia enforcement arm of the oligarchs. You know, whichever side needs a little boost will get that boost one way or another. And that's been the case at least since 2003, when the so-called election reforms put in these black box voting machines. And starting in 2003, we saw a huge diversion open up between the exit polls and the ostensible results. That's never happened before. And in foreign elections, when U.S. monitors would go and monitor elections in places like Latin America, they would say that if there's a discrepancy of more than a percentage point or two between the exit polls and the results, that means that something's wrong with the election. But now suddenly we have, ever since these black box machines were put in 2003, there's been this huge gap that just opened up and has stayed open. And the discrepancy has always favored the part, whoever, you know, is most desired to be in power by the oligarchy. For instance, in 2004, they wanted the Bush administration to get another 4 years because it would have been seen as a repudiation of 9/11 and the 9/11 wars if Kerry, the skull and bonesman, had beat Bush, the skull and bonesman. So that one was rigged. Kerry actually probably got a landslide victory. Probably he won by at least 6 and possibly as many as 10 points nationally. And he clearly won by a landslide in Ohio, and that was stolen from him. And Mike Connell, the computer engineer who stole the election for the Republicans and for Karl Rove, was scheduled to testify against Karl Rove when his plane went down. And so that's just, you know, I could go on about the election since then. But
wow, that's an interesting bit of history. Yeah.
Yeah. So whoever the oligarchs want to win is likely to get the thumbs on the scales in their favor. And historically, actually, since 2003, the Republicans have actually benefited from this as much as the Democrats. But once Trump changed the Republican Party and the oligarchs in the national security state decided he had to go, I think things changed. And in 2020, we saw that the down-ticket Republicans seemingly benefited, or at the very least, they were getting neutral treatment, but it looked like they were actually probably getting some help from the people who rigged the voting machines. But Trump didn't. At the top of the ticket, he was not beating the polls the way that the down ticket people were, which would indicate that somebody was pulling some kind of levers against Trump in 2020. As for the details of precisely how that would have been done, I'm still pretty agnostic. I haven't come across a really solid argument that explains to me precisely how that election would have been stolen. But certainly there are a lot of warning signs there. And in this election, again, they actually probably wanted about the results that they got. They didn't want a strong MAGA showing. They didn't want the Republicans to just totally take over Congress and be able to pass legislation and maybe even override some vetoes. they wanted this kind of split Congress that they're getting. So I think the oligarchs are pretty much dictating election results, and they can do it not only through black box voting machines and through these kinds of methods that we've seen in terms of ballot stuffing and the use of mail-in ballots and that sort of thing, which is really a smaller, you know, more minor way to steal votes. And then finally, they can do it invisibly through search engine algorithm manipulation and social media manipulation. There was a professor who did a very detailed study more than a decade ago showing that Google could easily throw an election, or Facebook even could easily throw an election. All they have to do is tweak their algorithms. They figure out, you know, who are the undecided voters, and then they tweak algorithms in such a way that the undecided voters see the stuff that's going to lead them to pull the lever or not pull the lever in the way that they need. So with all of these methods for manipulating elections, democracy is really pretty much dead.
Yeah, that's very well said. You brought up a lot of very good points, all of which I agree with. And voting fraud and election integrity have been issues that American Free Press has covered for years now, not just the 2020 election. I mean, going back to its founding, and then, of course, the spotlight before that. And yeah, I think we've had some major problems with American elections for a very, very long time. 2020 was just a very, very blatant, in-your-face example of that. And that has not been fixed. It doesn't appear to – nobody appears to be even trying to fix it or get to the bottom of it, at least nobody in charge. There's, you know, like independent people doing investigations and publishing documentaries. I went out and watched what is it, 10,000 Mules, I think was it, or 1,000 Mules?
The 2,000 or 3,000, some number of thousands.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact title, but I'm sure most people are familiar with that documentary or at least have heard of it. And I mean, they make a pretty good case. It's interesting. It's like you say, it's kind of difficult to figure out exactly how they do it. There is a number of different ways that are used to manipulate elections, all of which you sort of alluded to, and all of which play a role in this overall process in undermining, quote unquote, our cherished democracy, which is a total joke at this point. So again, I have very little faith in the integrity of our elections. I think some key races were definitely manipulated and stolen from Republicans. I'm thinking of, in particular, and again, not that I'm a fan of the Republicans, but I have a hard time believing Fetterman won in Pennsylvania. I have a very hard time believing Blake Masters lost in Arizona, and not to mention Carrie Lake, who was running for governor as a Republican. I have a hard time believing that she lost that governor race. So there was a lot of very suspicious things going on. And really, I tend to agree with you. I mean, I don't think much is really going to change. I mean, the Republicans do have a slight majority in the House now, which we noted in this current issue's front page article. Kevin McCarthy, who's going to be the incoming Speaker of the House, has announced that he's going to kick some top Democrats off of their committee assignments. But to me, this is more like political theater. You know, you see these Republicans, they're always threatening to hold investigations and hearings into Democrat criminality. But as far as I can tell, it's largely theater. I mean, take a look at their investigations into the FBI and what happened on January 6th and the way the FBI has been politicized against just average Trump supporters and people who simply attended a public protest at the Capitol on January 6th. And if you see the videos and the clips of FBI Director Christopher Wray totally stonewalling and disrespecting Congress in these hearings, it's a total embarrassment. So, I mean, I don't expect much to change substantially at all. And again, I have very little faith in the integrity of our elections, not to mention the major political parties. I mean, these people are totally controlled by these oligarchs, a term that I'm really glad that you've incorporated into the discussion, because, you know, you hear so much about Russian oligarchs, and America has their own set of oligarchs that are probably even more nefarious and sinister than the Russian oligarchs, if that can be, you know, imagined.
Well, the problem is that we don't have anybody that can stop our oligarchs. The Russians had that problem in the 1990s. They had oligarchs who were completely out of control, who could buy up political power. And then Russia reconstituted a strong state structure and brought their oligarchs to heel to a certain extent anyway, just like the CCP in China. I'm not a big fan of communism or the CCP, But you have to give them credit where credit's due. They are maintaining a fair system by essentially depriving rich people of the right to gain political power using their wealth. So the government in China actually decides, for instance, how money will be created. It gets created by being lent into existence for infrastructure. And here, the money creation system is essentially a big crony-style kind of charade with the Federal Reserve banksters and the Rothschild cartel creating as much money as they want and lavishing it on their friends. It's one big hog trough. So if we were going to try to get our oligarchs under control the way that China does, Iran to a certain extent does, and Russia to a certain extent does, we would have to have a strong kind of regulator in the state. And the regulations, the referee, can't be bribed and paid by the players. The referee has to have the incentive to call things honestly and to penalize anybody he wants. And in China, it doesn't matter if you're a billionaire. If you get caught for corruption, you're literally dead. They'll execute you. And that's how it should be. The billionaires are the first people who should be executed if they're corrupt. But what we have here in the West is these criminal cartels of billionaire organized crime figures who run everything. And they're the ones who decide who gets killed and who doesn't. And they get to buy up the political system. They own the referee. They own the regulators. And it's totally unacceptable. And it's not going, it's going to fall apart eventually of its own accord.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Very well said. I think there is a major lack of integrity and virtue amongst our political officials, you know, the federal bureaucracy, for example, coupled with a revolving door where, you know, you look at like for and this was on vivid display with this whole alleged COVID-19 pandemic, where the people in charge of quote unquote public health in America literally came from big pharma. And they're like, you know, it's basically an overlapping like on the one hand, you have like the regulators who are supposed to be regulating big pharma, yet it's big pharma representatives who are actually being the regulators. You know, there's this total overlap and there's no integrity. There's no virtue. There's no honesty. And, you know, that's what you get in America. very different in China and Russia, I'd imagine, or at least not to the extent that it is here. I mean, I'm sure there's some level of corruption taking place in all countries all over the world, but in America, it's just there's like zero integrity at all amongst these people.
Right. Yeah. I think there's still a fair bit of corruption in Russia, but there's a limit to how far they can go, and they can't just buy political power. They don't tell Putin what to do. You know, Putin is sort of an arbiter among all of the different power factions in Russia. But ultimately, it's his word that goes. No oligarch owns him, and no oligarch owns the central Russian state. And unfortunately, this cartel of criminal oligarchs does own our government. Now, China, I think, is actually cleaner. Again, it's not a system I particularly like. The ideology of communism, I think, is profoundly misguided. But they've used it to create a system that has a certain amount of virtue in terms of having a very strong anti-corruption ethic. And Iran is also not too bad in that regard. They, like Russia, you know, they still have some oligarchs that they have to kind of try to keep under control. They have a fifth column, just like Russia has, although Russia is starting to clean out their fifth column now in the light of this Ukraine war. But yeah, we really need to find a way to reinstate a relatively honest set of regulators, you know, starting with enforcing the antitrust laws. You know, if we actually enforced our antitrust laws that are on the books, we would just bust up almost all of these big corporations and confiscate the wealth of a lot of these billionaires. You know, Twitter, Facebook, Google. I mean, those are all run by our national security state and its mafia oligarch masters. So it wouldn't really be that big of a step to declare a national emergency and seize them as public property and run them as public utilities under the First Amendment. And that's what I think Trump should have done. And again, you know, Trump was portrayed as a maniac. And of course, they would have done everything they could to stop him from doing anything that drastic. But ultimately, I thought that was, you know, kind of our last hope would be Trump standing up for free speech and going up against social media. But instead, he just put out a statement and didn't really do anything. And we're stuck where we are. So we are going to need some kind of revolution, I think, to fundamentally change anything.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's a main part or a main argument you make in your current column in American Free Press is, you know, how social media platforms should be regulated. And we'll get to that in just a moment. There was just one final topic I wanted to bring up relating to the election, and a topic that we covered in the front page story of this current issue. And that is, of course, I mean, we talked about the role of big money in American elections, but also the role that powerful organized political lobbies, especially the pro-Israel lobby, plays in American elections. And I was reading, I follow the organization AIPAC on Twitter, and you should see their Twitter feed. I mean, they're just like openly bragging how they basically control everybody in Congress. And I had some interesting quotes in this article. AIPAC has proudly supported 100% of the House Democratic and Republican leadership. We are proud to stand with pro-Israel Democrats and Republicans to strengthen bipartisan support for the U.S.-Israel relationship. Being pro-Israel is good policy and good politics, they announced. They also put out a tweet where they were basically bragging that over 95% of the congressional candidates that they backed in this current election won their election and are going to Congress. So, I mean, we're basically – when over 95% of these people are essentially controlled and influenced by AIPAC, of course we're going to have a totally pro-Israel Congress once again. This is something that's been happening every single election cycle. And it's just interesting the way these people – will get up there and openly talk about it and brag about it on Twitter. And yet, if you like mention this, you're an anti-Semitic conspiracy theorist, which ties into many of the other topics we're going to talk about. But I'm just curious if you saw any of that, any of those tweets from AIPAC, or if you have any comments on that. This is something that most people are aware of, but I just find it incredible the brazen way in which they sort of boast about this, and yet it's something you can't even publicly comment on without being denounced as a racist or an anti-Semite.
Well, yeah, that's what they say in Yiddish. The word is chutzpah. They brag openly. Hey, we own your country. What are you going to do about it? You know, imagine if the pro-Russia lobby elected the entire Congress like that and bragged about how they owned our government. But the Israelis can get away with that for some reason. I guess they've terrorized everybody into submission with this insane propaganda about how opposing these genocidal gangsters is so-called anti-Semitism. Well, you know, opposing genocidal gangsters like that is just common sense. And somehow, you know, I guess it's because this crime cartel owns our media. It owns much of the financial sector, totally dominates Hollywood, of course. They call the shots, and they don't even have to hide the fact that they've taken over our country. And it's really completely shameful. And, you know, Americans, if they actually knew what had been done to their country, they'd really have a choice between, you know, shooting themselves in the head and rising up in a revolution against these people. I mean, when I talk about the oligarchy, of course, half the oligarchs or so are Jewish Zionists. That is, they're people who have been brought up with this fanatical ideology that, oh, everybody wants to kill us. And that means we can do anything we want. We can commit every crime. We have the right to, you know, get out of jail card no matter what we do. And they behave like total tribal psychopaths. Now, these are the people that now run our country, and they've taken it over, and they're running it for their benefit and to everybody else's detriment.
Yes, sir. You got that spot on. And it's interesting the way that the Holocaust narrative is so central to these individuals' ideology and their perspective, their political outlook. You know, you look at like a group like the Anti-Defamation League, who's literally attempting to extort Twitter and Elon Musk and dictate how this man is going to manage and operate his platform. And just the nerve that these people have, and much of it centers around their this idea of historic persecution, and of course that is epitomized by the alleged Holocaust story of World War II. It's like a fundamental aspect of their identity. It's what drives everything that they do. And again, it's something that you're not even allowed to question, let alone comment on.
Well, that's right. The Jewish elite throughout 3,000 years of history has acted like a pack of psychopathic bullies. And they bully their own people first and foremost, in part, by when they prey on the larger communities of non-Jews around them, then the ordinary Jewish people end up being the targets of the reprisals. And that dynamic has been going on for 3,000 years. So there are high IQ, psychopathic, elite Jews, just as there's the same kind of dynamic in other ethnic groups as well. But I think it's really carried to an extreme in the Jewish community. And this psychopathic elite has done what a lot of psychopaths have figured out, that they can get away with their crimes simply by claiming to be victims. Martha Stout, in her work on psychopathy, calls that the victim card is the very first card that a psychopath plays. They cry crocodile tears and pretend to be the victim. And this the elite Jews, not all Jews, but the elite Jews, have been perfecting that tactic over the course of 3,000 years. And everybody knows it. And, you know, every culture where the Jews have been, you have these sayings like, you know, the Jew cries out as he strikes you.
Right. Yeah.
And it's, of course, and again, the ordinary Jews end up bearing the brunt of the reprisals for this, because their elite are basically gangsters who have reached their levels of wealth and power through tribally enhanced psychopathic behavior, or what Lauren Guyonneau calls tribal psychopathy. That is, the whole tribe behaves towards non-members of the tribe the way an individual psychopath behaves towards other human beings. But these individual elite Jews are very often psychopathic in their personal deportment as well. I've been reading Whitney Webb's book about Jeffrey Epstein and his network. And that network, you know, basically covers the whole American and Western deep state. And it is top heavy with psychopathic Jewish Zionist gangsters. So those are really that's the power center that most dominates the West. And they've insulated themselves from any criticism and exposure by making up these bizarre myths about how persecuted they are. They're actually, of course, the persecutors, the bullies, the people who run the world. And anybody who says a word against them or breathes a word of truth about what they're doing becomes a target. And then they can whip out their victim card, as psychopaths always do.
Right. Yes. Well, there are some people, some very influential people in society that are actually talking about the Jews lately. And of course, I'm referring to Kanye West, or Ye, as he's known now, who is easily one of the wealthiest black rappers and entertainers in America. A pro basketball star, Kyrie Irving, who plays for the Brooklyn Nets, I believe. And then most recently, comedian Dave Chappelle, who did one of the most epic monologues in Saturday Night Live history, in my opinion. And of course, this all sort of relates to the concepts of free speech, anti-Semitism, the role that organized Jewry plays in society. And this ties in directly to the controversy surrounding Twitter and Elon Musk, who is now the owner of Twitter. And of course, these are topics that you and I both wrote about in this current edition of American Free Press. I actually wrote a couple articles in the previous edition of the newspaper as well, addressing the Kanye West controversy and also the efforts of the ADL to boycott Twitter, to launch an economic boycott of Twitter, or I should say an advertiser boycott of Twitter, in an attempt to undermine and totally implode the company, implode the platform, because Elon Musk wasn't playing ball to their liking. Now, before we get started, I want to actually just kind of focus on what Ye has said, the controversy surrounding Kanye West. He has basically just totally refused to back down or apologize for his comments and his actions, which included originally, I mean, before he was really criticizing Jews, what kind of sparked a lot of this anyways was he was wearing a White Lives Matters shirt at a major fashion show in Paris in early October. And then he sort of doubled down and just, you know, elaborated on his views and said some other pretty controversial, explosive things in an interview with Tucker Carlson. And then after that is when, you know, things really started spiraling out of control, at least for people like the ADL who are concerned about, quote unquote, anti-Semitism spreading in sort of mainstream society. He went on a number of alternative media channels and appeared in interviews where he further exposed the very sinister and dark forces controlling Hollywood, entertainment, and sports, especially black entertainers and musicians and athletes. He basically insinuated, if not outright claimed, that a powerful network of Jews control, manipulate, and exploit, and intimidate, and extort celebrities, and also, of course, wield, tremendous influence in society, especially in politics and media. And I wanted to just briefly read from the article I wrote in issue 47 and 48 talking about Kanye West. He did a podcast with a Jewish, I believe he's a computer scientist, and he's a very popular podcast host named Lex Friedman, and you can find him on YouTube. And he basically said that Jews essentially controlled his voice, as well as 90% of other black people in entertainment. So basically he was saying that like Jews are like the right-hand men of these people and sort of manipulate them and control them and exploit them and in many cases make a lot of money off of them. And he also pointed out how powerful Jews like Rahm Emanuel, for example, and Jared Kushner operate similarly in politics. And of course, Rahm Emanuel worked very closely with former President Barack Obama. I believe he was Obama's chief of staff, and then
he was Obama's handler. Yeah. Pasternak was using.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. And that's basically what Kanye said. And Rahm Emanuel certainly was. I mean, he was his chief of staff, so I mean, he was like his right hand man. Just as now, there's a Jewish guy under Biden who's his chief of staff. But he pointed out how Rahm Emanuel basically worked as Obama's handler, while Jared Kushner basically worked as Donald Trump's handler. And he said, there's a Jewish person right there controlling the company. I'm sorry, controlling the country, referring to these individuals, just using them as an example. And basically saying that this is exactly how Hollywood and sports and entertainment work as well. Right? So this is something that obviously people like us are well aware of, but here's Kanye West explaining this in very layman's terms to millions of people, to people that are probably not all that interested in politics, and yet here's Kanye West just openly describing these things and doing so very accurately, frankly. I mean, this is how politics works. This is how entertainment works. You have these guys that are handlers, and they work to manipulate and to basically keep these celebrities and politicians in line and to basically do the bidding of these globalist oligarchs that control the country. What did you think about the Kanye West controversy?
Yeah, no, I think he's in trouble, not because of the goofy things he said, and he said a few goofy things, but because of the truth in what he says. And he's absolutely right about this role of these networks of Jewish handlers. And he's seen that firsthand in Hollywood. Now, the question arises, well, why is that? Why is that if you're looking for a representative or, a handler, an agent, somebody to help you do well in the entertainment business, you're probably going to hire a Jewish person? And, why would that be? Why Jews are only 2% of the population or less? So why are they probably a great majority of these talent agents and other forms of handlers? And likewise in politics, of course. And I think the answer has to do with ethnic nepotism and networking. That is, that if you want to do well in entertainment, you need to have a promoter and an agent who are plugged in to the business networks. And those business networks are disproportionately Jewish. In Hollywood, they're pretty much 100% Jewish. So you have no choice. You have to have somebody who is either Jewish themselves, or they could be a token goy or a Shabbat goy who happens to be plugged into the Jewish ethnic network. And that's the only way you're going to succeed in those businesses. And that is, it's similarly in politics. When Obama was asked why he had hired Rahm Emanuel as his chief of staff, he muttered something like, "We owed some people." And I'm pretty sure that's actually the direct quote. We owed some people.
Wow. Incredible.
Like the Pritzker family probably is who he was talking about, a mobbed up Chicago billionaire family that made Obama what he was. So that is how it works. And this all gets back to that issue of Jewish ethnic nepotism. I recently had a discussion with Ken Meyercord on my radio show, and people can find that by going to truthjihad.com and find your way to the radio show link. And Ken had just had a sort of a revelation, and he had discovered a website. I think it was called something like Jewish or Not Jewish. And when he looked at that website, his first thought was, oh, these are a bunch of Nazis who are trying to expose people as Jews, like the anti-Jewish people who put three parentheses around people's names to show that they're Jewish. So Ken looked at this website, Jewish or Not Jewish, and then he realized that from the way it was written, it had to be a Jewish website that was catering to Jewish people. Because, and well, why, he wondered, would Jewish people be so interested in who's Jewish and, you know, give them a rating of how Jewish they are from 1 to 20 or something like that? And he realized that it did have to do partly with a kind of ethnic networking, ethnic pride, of course, but that also transitions into ethnic nepotism, where people, you know, just like the gay people have a gaydar where they can sort of sense who's gay and who isn't, and then they help each other. And this is true. I mean, there's a little bit of this kind of nepotism in all sorts of groups, but Jews have really perfected it. And that's why in media in particular, there are really, there's so little non-Jewish power. And there's a really good article about this by a guy who used to work for the New York Times, Philip Weiss, who has since become a critic of Zionism. He's a Jewish guy himself, and his article is called Do We Jews Control the Media, or Do We Dominate Media? And So What If We Do? And he explains how almost the majority of his bosses and key players in mainstream media that he's worked with have been Jewish. And then he asks about, well, how did that come about? And he says, well, obviously, it's like I myself feel more comfortable with Jewish people than non-Jewish people. So if there are two candidates for a job that come in and interview, I'm just probably going to unconsciously just pick the Jewish person because I feel more comfortable. And, you know, Philip Weiss, who's anti-Zionist and a free thinker and a very sharp guy, feels that way. You can sort of imagine how sort of average Jewish business operators, the kind of people that run Hollywood, all the producers and the agents and the talent scouts, all those people are doing the same thing in spades. So that's how it works. And politics has gotten strangled by this Jewish ethnic network. Hollywood is totally owned pretty much 100% by it, as Joel Stein wrote in his great article, Who Runs Hollywood? Come on. And you know, our financial sector is largely operating this way. And some people criticize those of us who point this out by saying that, well, it's probably not nepotism. It's just that Jews are so smart. Well, up to a certain point, yeah, I think Jews are probably overall a relatively talented group. However, let's look at the quantitative work that Ron Unz cites in his recent article about Ivy League university admissions. And he shows that Jews are being admitted to Ivy League universities in wild disproportion to their abilities. That is, Jews of relatively low abilities are being brought into the Ivy League in huge numbers. And people of other ethnicities, especially Asians and especially non-Jewish white people, are being turned away from Ivy League universities in favor of demonstrably less qualified Jewish candidates. And this can be all shown very easily statistically. And of course, every admissions officer of every Ivy League university is Jewish. And I think all of the presidents of those universities, except one, are Jewish, and that one is married to a Jew. Just like everybody in Biden's cabinet is either Jewish or married to a Jew. And so I think that ethnic nepotism is a key concept that we need to understand. And that's what we should be talking about. There's nothing racist about talking about ethnic nepotism. And in places like Indonesia and Malaysia, where the indigenous people have lost so much power and so much wealth to a Chinese diaspora, they are very aware of the fact that they host this minority Chinese diaspora that grabs the lion's share of wealth and business opportunities in Malaysia and Indonesia. And the Malaysians and Indonesians, to some extent, have organized against that to try to limit the extent to which this small minority of ethnically Chinese people totally takes over and runs a country like Malaysia. So there are laws that restrict what ethnically Chinese people can do. There are laws that force a certain number of representatives to be actually ethnic Malays. And quite frankly, something like that maybe needs to be done here in the United States. And of course, that would be portrayed as a racist remark and a, you know, oh, well, you must love Adolf Hitler.
But yeah, that's precisely. Yeah, well, that's precisely what Adolf Hitler and the National Socialists attempted to do. And, you know, look at how they're demonized
look at how
today.
That turned out.
Yeah. Well, see, and, yeah. You know, there's so many things to comment on. One thing right off the bat I want to mention is in the aftermath of all this, just over the course of the past few days, there have been a number of very revealing articles to come out about this whole drama surrounding Kanye and Dave Chappelle and Kyrie Irving. One I'm looking at right here, this is from the Times of Israel. Here's the headline. And this is written by a Jewish writer. Chappelle is right. There are a lot of Jews in Hollywood. That is literally the title of the article.
And that's sort of like the Pope is Catholic.
I mean, right. well, that's the thing. Like, you can go read like the Times of Israel or the Jewish Telegraph Agency, where they will just explain all of this. And like, you know, it's no secret. Yeah, of course, Jews run Hollywood. They run the media. They run, you know, banking, etc. So that's one example. And there have been others. You mentioned the iconic Joel Stein?
Joel Stein. Yeah, wrote that LA Times article called "Who Runs Hollywood?" Come on.
Exactly. Yeah, and that was, I think, in 2009 he wrote that. And just totally. And this is and Joel Stein, surprise, surprise, is a Jewish writer, and he just was openly documenting these facts, and even at the end bragged about it and said that I don't care if Americans think we're running these industries. I just care that we get to continue to run them. And of course they have continued to run all of these industries, and they have for a very long time. There was another article in the Jewish Telegraph Agency. The headline is Dave Chappelle isn't the first to suggest that Jews run Hollywood. Here are the origins of the trope. And they describe it as a trope. I should probably look up exactly what the definition of trope is.
Yeah, the Pope being Catholic is a trope.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's incredible. It's like literally like just a truthful statement. It's a figurative or metaphorical use of a word or expression. So they use these words like a trope or a canard or a conspiracy theory to basically just demonize anybody pointing these facts out. And yet, again, here's an article in the Jewish Telegraph Agency that says, here's a quote from it, "Nearly every major movie studio was founded in the early 20th century by a group of first-generation secular Jews who immigrated to the United States from Eastern Europe. There's entire books written about this subject, including by Jewish authors." So, I mean, just this idea that we, like, can't notice these things and talk about it. And that was really the... like, that goes to the heart of Dave Chappelle's monologue, was that, yes, all this stuff is true about the Jews controlling Hollywood and all these other things. It's just crazy to say it out loud. It's not crazy to think that or notice it. It's crazy to say it out loud because of the negative social and economic repercussions. And we saw what happened with Kanye West. He literally lost, like, every single contract that he had. His net worth went from over $2 billion to – I'm not even sure what it is right now, but – he basically got blacklisted and thrown out of the industry, kicked out of all of the major contracts and deals that he had.
And of course, that proves there's no such thing as Jewish power.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, you know, they're going to try to ruin his life. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And this has happened to other people in Hollywood or in entertainment or in sports, like Kyrie Irving and Dave Chappelle's monologue on Saturday Night Live. He had a funny line where he said, "Kanye got in so much trouble, Kyrie got in trouble." And he was referring to, of course, Kyrie Irving, who really didn't even say anything as far as I'm aware. He basically posted a link to a documentary video that is available for sale on Amazon.com. And he posted a link. He didn't make any comments. He basically just posted a link for people to look at and click on and maybe take a look on Amazon and purchase it, or maybe watch it on Amazon. I don't know. I haven't seen the documentary, but it's one of these like Black Hebrew Israelite type documentaries that apparently makes references to Jews being involved in the slave trade, which is a historical fact that has been thoroughly documented and detailed by organizations like the Nation of Islam. Dr. David Duke has written and talked about this subject extensively, and there have been a number of other scholars who have looked into this, and in many cases, again, are like literally quoting Jewish historians and Jewish journalists who have documented these facts. And yet, you know, the ADL went after him big time. The NBA came down on him. He was suspended. I believe he actually was just allowed to play recently, he was allowed to return to the team, but he got in all sorts of trouble. The ADL was openly extorting this man publicly. I mean, how embarrassing is this? I mean, how are you going to let yourself get treated like this by these people? It's unbelievable the way they operate, and they do so brazenly. They did it with Kyrie. They've attempted to do it with Kanye West. Now they're attempting to do it with Elon Musk. I mean, it's just outrageous the way these people operate, and yet you can't even say anything without being denounced and canceled and, you know, having your livelihood ruined in many cases. It's just totally unacceptable. And yet these people operate as if they're above the law. They operate as total gangsters, openly extorting people.
That's true. Yeah, I don't have a whole lot to add to that. I think you summed it up very well. I guess, you know, Chappelle in particular, I thought it's kind of interesting that he took less heat than Kyrie Irving did, and a lot less than Kanye West did. Now, of course, Kyrie Irving hadn't really done very much, but Dave Chappelle had, you know, really deliberately talked about this stuff in a very biting way. You know, the whole subject of his comic monologue was, hey, you know, there's a gun to my head, and I'm not supposed to mention that there's a gun to my head, but you know, there's a gun to my head. He basically kept saying, well, I'm not supposed to say this, but then he said it anyway. And it's quite hilarious. And I think that there was one of the representatives of the Jewish lobby that was really outraged and said that, you know, what Chappelle did was much, much worse than, you know, Kanye West. Everybody knows Kanye West is crazy, but, you know, Dave Chappelle, he was normalizing anti-Semitism. And I think he got away with it, of course, in part because it's so funny that, you know, there's a certain sense in which, you know, if you tell the truth, make it funny or they'll kill you is the old line. And it's true. You can get away with telling certain kinds of truths if there's a certain element of humor there, which there certainly was in Dave Chappelle's monologue. And I think maybe part of the problem, too, is that they're afraid to go after Chappelle because he can win the argument. You know, I don't think Kanye West is personally going to really win the argument with his persecutors. He's very telegenic and he's a good rapper and everything, but I'm not sure that he can win the factual debate in a kind of, you know, legalistic way. And likewise, Kyrie Irving, who I think is a very smart guy, you know, he loves these outrageous, outlandish conspiracy approaches to things, but he's right about a lot of them. He was certainly right not to get vaccinated. And he's also probably, though, somebody who's not going to win the debate. But if they go after Dave Chappelle, as he showed in his monologue, he is sharp, really sharp at the way he talks about this stuff. And I think, you know, they realized that going head to head with Chappelle it wouldn't really work. And additionally, a certain number of sort of ordinary Jewish people of good faith, you know, who are a product of their conditioning to a certain extent, but who also are not, you know, tribal lunatics like a certain percentage of the, especially the upper echelons of that community, kind of the normal Jewish people of good faith look at what Dave Chappelle said and they laugh. You know, they say, ah, they recognize some truth. And it's just they react to it a lot, you know, not that differently from how we react to it. And so that kind of split the Jewish community, you know, between the relatively sane ones and the lunatics. So I think.
Yeah, I've noticed. Yeah, I've noticed that, too. There have been some people. You mentioned the guy Adam Feldman, who was hysterical. He's actually the theater editor and critic for Time Out New York, which is like a sort of like a New York City like tourism type website. At least that's what it seems like based on when I went there the other day when I was looking into his background and stuff. He's the one that said that Chappelle did more to normalize anti-Semitism than anything Kanye West ever said. And it's just incredible. I mean, I think right from the beginning, well, first off, did you see the report? It was an anonymous source who told Page Six, which is an entertainment outlet connected to the New York Post, told one of their journalists that Dave Chappelle actually did a fake monologue during the dress rehearsal to conceal his, you know, what he actually wanted to say. I thought that was incredible, and that is the only thing that makes sense to me. I mean, there's no way that these producers would have allowed.
Lauren Michaels is the main producer, and
yeah,
he is Jewish,
and he's a Jewish guy. Yeah,
he's not known to be iconoclastic, so he probably wouldn't have liked the the monologue of Kanye.
I don't think so. Yeah, no, I don't think so. I thought that was incredibly interesting, and really makes me think very highly of Dave Chappelle. I've always thought Dave Chappelle has actually been pretty funny. I haven't really followed his career all that closely, you know, over the years. But I mean, he's always, you know, he's like one of the most iconic entertainers and comedians in American history, probably at this point.
Yeah, my wife turned me on to him maybe 5 years ago or something, and I'm glad she did.
Yeah, he's always been pretty funny. He's very witty. He's obviously a very intelligent man, and I think just the way he started things off was brilliant. The way he went out and like basically denounced anti-Semitism, and he stands with his friends in the Jewish community. And then he made a joke about Kanye, like, look, man, this is how you buy yourself time, is you have to, grovel before these people and say you stand with them and denounce anti-Semitism. So, I mean, right off the bat, he sort of like disarmed everybody. And sort of led into this topic. And I mean, he handled it brilliantly. He went on to say some other things about like Russiagate and Trump and stuff that I didn't necessarily agree with, but his comments about the whole controversy surrounding Kanye and Kyrie Irving were totally spot on. And he said a lot of very, very powerful things. And again, right off the bat, shortly after he made that opening joke, he went on to say that in his 35-year career in show business and entertainment, he learned that there are two words in the English language that you should never say in sequence, and those words are the and Jews. And that is so true. And again, that highlights like the main th point that he was making is that you just cannot publicly notice and comment on Jewish power and influence in the United States, no matter how obvious it is, no matter how detrimental it is to the interests of the average people in this country. It's something you are not allowed to talk about. You're not allowed to notice, at least in a public way, without some serious repercussions coming down upon you.
Yeah, as he said, if it's Italians, it's a mafia. If it's blacks, it's a gang. If it's Jews, you better not talk about it.
Yeah, exactly, right. Exactly. That's again, it goes to the heart of this whole controversy. And it really goes to the heart of what anti-Semitism really is, and that is just noticing what the Jews are up to and noticing their power and how they operate, the agendas that they push, these sorts of things. That's all it really is. It's not like a blind hatred of Jewish people. It's simply noticing what they're up to. And he also made a couple of other very interesting comments. And again, Chappelle is an icon in American entertainment. As he mentioned, he's been in this business for 35 years at a very high level, at the highest level possible. And he went out there and said, look, don't get mad at me. I've been in this industry for a very long time. I've been to Hollywood. And guess what, guys? It's a lot of Jews that are in Hollywood. And he like basically joked
I
about
mean, a
it.
lot.
Yeah. You got to watch the, if anybody listening has not seen the monologue, it is absolutely worth watching. It's like 15 minutes and it is just absolutely brilliant. At least like I said, this portion where he focused on Kanye and Kyrie and everything. And then he went on to say, again, going back to my point, he said it's not a crazy thing to think that the Jews run the show business, but it is a crazy thing to say out loud in a climate like this. And so again, just I thought that that was brilliant. I mean, really, that really, if anybody with an open mind is watching this or listening to Chappelle's monologue, they've got to connect the dots and recognize that what he's saying is absolutely true. And I mean, the whole controversy with Kanye West, with Kyrie Irving, and with Elon Musk and Twitter totally demonstrates that. And that's a topic we can get into too, because I know that was a main feature of your current column.
The whole Twitter wars have taken a kind of unfortunate turn now, as it looks like Musk is going to try to stop the bleeding, right? The same ADL and other pressure groups pushed Elon Musk to try to keep the censorship, and he took over Twitter with the express intention of rolling back the censorship. But unfortunately, he hasn't really followed through, and you can see why, because his investment in Twitter was already pretty speculative, and it was probably overvalued. He has this grandiose ambition to turn Twitter into a sort of all-purpose app that's like WePay in China, but whether that works out or not is kind of a long shot. And so when all the advertisers suddenly start boycotting Twitter because Elon Musk is going to try to bring on free speech, that is going to take a big bite out of his bottom line. And so he may have lost more billions of dollars than Kanye West did. And he quickly started backtracking and said, well, yeah, okay, I'll re reinstate Trump, but not Alex Jones. And so with my article, I was asking, well, why is there this difference between who's allowed to say what? Kanye West is totally crucified. Kyrie Irving, compared to what he said, is totally crucified. Dave Chappelle kind of gets away with it. And then with Twitter, Elon Musk starts out standing up for free speech, and then the next thing he reinstates Trump, but not Alex Jones. Well, what are the rules about who can say what and suffer what consequences or not? And I think in the case of Twitter, it's actually in all of these cases, what's really going on is that there is this huge censorship industry, which is primarily part of this Zionist crime cartel that dominates so many sectors of power in the United States. And that censorship industry is just going to go after people who rub it the wrong way. And like I said, Chappelle got away with it by virtue of his verbal nimbleness, I guess, and his humor. And as for Trump versus Alex Jones, it seems that Musk was able to use this poll that he ran in which Bring Back Trump won 52-48% as cover for his decision to reinstate Trump's account. He didn't run any similar poll for Alex Jones, of course. And you get the sense that he's sort of trying to walk this fine line where he can make enough changes to sort of pretend that he hasn't completely sold out, while at the same time not alienating his persecutors to the point that they utterly crush him. Now, Ron Unz wrote a really good article on this a couple of days ago, pointing out that if this censorship lobby can crush Musk, if they can just totally, you know, force him to change his plans, if somebody like Elon Musk, the world's richest man, can't go up against them, then who can? What chance do any of us have? And that's a pretty good question. And then Unz also pointed out, though, that, you know, he himself has managed to really wave, you know, like a bullfighter waving a red flag in front of the ADL and its friends, the censorship industry. Ron Unz has done an American Pravda series on a lot of these hot button topics that they want to keep covered up. World War II revisionism, of course, 9/11 truth, JFK truth, in all cases pointing the finger at the Zionists as the bad guys. So, you know, Ron Unz wrote a piece that I found a little extreme in which he endorsed these claims that Jews have indeed done these ritual blood sacrifices of goy children, that's not entirely mythical. And I thought Ron kind of even overstated that one a little bit. So he's really waving the red flag in front of the bull, and yet the bull won't come after him. Why is that? Well, I think to a certain extent, Ron is benefiting from the same thing that Dave Chappelle was benefiting from, which is a certain dexterity of and virtuosity even of language and wit and the ability to potentially actually win a debate. And then to benefit actually from the publicity. Like, I think that the ADL, when it went after Dave Chappelle, realized that it wasn't getting the kind of backing, you know, the kind of majority backing that it needs to really crush somebody. So then they backed off. And similarly, I think when they go after someone like Ron Unz, they realize that they're probably doing him more of a favor by publicizing him than they are harming him. He's independently wealthy enough. Unz can continue to do what he's doing. And nothing the ADL can do can really prevent Unz's ability to keep publishing. So I think that kind of strategic thinking that Unz talks about in that article, where, you know, you think about how can you confront them in such a way that they come at any, if they decide to come after you, they're actually just shooting themselves in the foot. I think Unz has done that. Dave Chappelle, to a certain extent, did that. I've tried to do that too. And they've come after me many times. And I think each time there were two big waves of persecution. One was after I came out for 9/11 truth in 2006. And then they, you know, after a year of persecution, they backed off. I realized they were just giving me publicity. And then the same thing happened again in 2015, 2016. I published some books that they didn't like. And suddenly I was getting ADL fatwas left and right. The president of France put me at the top of the list of the people that needed to be censored. And, then once again, I think they realized that they were just doing me a favor by putting out these fatwas, and they stopped and started ignoring me. So I think that if we think strategically about how to go after them in such a way that they don't really have a good avenue to respond, and that any response actually, you know, hurts them more than it helps them, is one way to think about this. And then if we're going to build a movement that can ultimately beat them, it would have to be that kind of thinking, but in spades.
Right. Yeah, those are all really good points. And one of the points that you make actually in your piece is the very concept of free speech. I mean, it's not, you know, you don't need a majority to approve, you know, your free speech. On the contrary, its whole rationale is to protect unpopular speech. And Elon Musk does not appear to be abiding by that basic free speech principle, at least at this point. It's kind, you know, he's kind of he's very much like Trump in a sense where it's hard to get a good read on him because he says things and he does things and then the next day, you know, it's like he's backtracking on that. Like a perfect example is like originally he met with the ADL and was like saying, "Oh, you know, I'm meeting with quote unquote civil society leaders." He was basically meeting with the ADL and other groups that the ADL basically manipulates to do their bidding, essentially. And you know, he was saying that he was going to work with them to, you know, make changes on Twitter and to ensure hate speech and harassment and stuff wouldn't, you know, flourish on Twitter. And then on November 4th, the ADL came out and said that they were launching this advertising boycott against Twitter. And they basically denounced Elon Musk. And Elon Musk sort of fired back at them in the days after that, saying that he was going to expose the people that were behind this. You know, it's extremely messed up what they're doing. He was going to launch a thermonuclear name and shame campaign to expose these extortionists.
Sounds like
And
DEFCON 2.
yeah, yeah. Well, and he doesn't even need to do that. I mean, you could go to the ADL's website and they're openly telling you what they're doing. You know, they founded this organization called StopHateForProfit.org. You can go to that website and check it out. And it's basically an ADL organization. I mean, there's a bunch of other like nonprofit, quote unquote, civil rights organizations involved with it as well. But it's basically run and managed and dictated by the ADL. And so this organization launched this big campaign against Elon Musk. He came out and he was really upset about it. Twitter was losing like, I don't even know. He claimed like $4 million a day. I don't know if that's true or not, but they were losing a lot of money, needless to say. And then he came out saying that he was going to, I have the actual quote here. He said he was going to basically censor hate speech on Twitter. He said negative slash hate tweets will be max deboosted and demonetized. So no ads or other revenue to Twitter. And then he said you won't find the tweet unless you specifically seek it out, which is no different from the rest of the internet. And I mean, obviously the question is, who decides what a negative or hate tweet actually is? And what even is that? I mean, that's really what this that's the million-dollar question right there. And for far too long, groups like the ADL have been in charge of answering that question and dictating to social media platforms what can and can't be said on these platforms, which really, at the end of the day, is the public square in the 21st century. This is where the conversations are being had. This is where people are informing themselves, debating ideas, being confronted with, you know, a wide variety of perspectives. And that's the way it should be. That's the power of the internet. And these people are trying to totally stifle that and corral it into a direction that benefits them and totally eliminates anybody criticizing anything they're doing, or even pointing out basic facts about their agenda and what they're up to.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that's what we need to reinstate the First Amendment and the jurisprudence around the First Amendment as the basis for the rules for free speech online and off here in the United States. And that's what I advocated at the end of my new article. It seems to me that that history of jurisprudence around the First Amendment is overall pretty good. I mean, I disagree with some of it, but historically, for the most part, it's been recognized that there are certain kinds of speech that don't deserve this protection, and that would include defamation and incitement, a solicitation to commit a crime, and a few other categories as well. But the true threats, of course, being one of them, and an obscenity of various kinds. So it makes sense that those things wouldn't be protected. And what deserves the most protection, according to this tradition of First Amendment jurisprudence, is political speech, especially unpopular political speech. So if we use that as the yardstick for what is allowed on Twitter, and that's what Elon Musk had originally suggested he was going to do, it would actually be pretty easy, I think, to moderate speech properly. You know, if there's stuff that arguably could cross the line into illegal speech, then Twitter could, you know, basically they could train their moderators in the First Amendment jurisprudence tradition, and then they could decide if something looks illegal, or, you know, there's a prima facie case that this particular tweet is illegal, then it could be, you know, taken down pending some kind of due process. And that wouldn't be really that hard to do. But the problem with that, of course, is that the censorship industry, which, of course, as you said, the head of the octopus there is the ADL, is absolutely hell-bent on destroying the First Amendment and the whole tradition of jurisprudence around it, because they realize that if people speak the truth about some of these sensitive topics, especially Zionist and Jewish power, that there will be outrage and changes will be made. And so their power and wealth depends on suppressing free speech, dispassionate political speech about facts even. And so they can't live with a First Amendment standard, and they're using all of their mafia style power to try to prevent it from ruling Twitter and the rest of social media.
Yes, and that is so obviously on display with their hysterical reaction to Elon Musk, who has simply hinted at this sort of free speech type platform he wants to create. And then, of course, he backtracks and tries to work with the ADL, and yet they still launch this boycott against him. And they were openly, basically, I mean, I don't know how this is not extortion, and I don't know why Elon Musk does not kick these people off of Twitter. On November 18th, so just a few days ago, the ADL, this is the ADL's official Twitter feed. It's verified. It's got the blue check. And it says here, whatever happens to Twitter, new social platforms need to center trust and safety from the outset or risk being subject to the same fate. In the meantime, Elon Musk has put Twitter on death watch. It didn't have to be this way. Can you imagine the nerve of these people to say this? And for Elon Musk to sit there and take it and not do anything and not respond and not kick these people off of Twitter. I mean, that's what he should do. You know, it's just the way these people operate is just so outrageous and so brazen. And as you said, their whole strategy relies on anybody pointing this stuff out and talking about it frankly and openly being shut down and being prevented from, you know, openly discussing these things. So it's just infuriating, and it's going to be interesting to see how Elon handles all this. I mean, I think his basic policy is going to be essentially what Twitter has always been, at least in my experience. You're not going to be seen or heard. You're basically going to be shadow banned if you're telling the truth on Twitter and posting controversial perspectives and thoughts on any number of topics. I mean, I've been basically shadow banned on Twitter for years now. You know what I mean? I'm sure you have too. Yeah, I was going to say that's basically how it works. And I think that's probably what he's going to ultimately do. But if he were a true champion of free speech, he would be going after the ADL because they're total opponents of that sort of mindset. And they make that very, very clear. And I think your overall argument about the need of basically seizing these social media companies and running them as public utilities in accordance with the First Amendment is, I mean, that's really the only solution, you know, to rectify these things and to prevent organizations like the ADL from literally dictating every little thing that happens on these platforms.
Yeah, right. I'm surprised Harley Pasternak didn't tweet a threat at Elon Musk that you're going to be hospitalized and drugged and welcome to zombie.
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't even actually comment on that. That was another thing I pointed out in the article I wrote about Kanye West, which is another incredible revelation. And again, I mean, this is another example. The nerve of a guy like that to say that to Kanye West, I mean, it's just is so foreign to me, you know, for to sit up and try to talk to somebody like that and threaten them like that and to think that you can get away with it is just it
takes
so,
chutzpah.
Yeah, boy, I'll tell you what, it certainly does. And so I mean, we'll see what happens. Your article was excellent. I completely agree with your overall conclusion that look, these platforms, which again really are the public space, the area where conversations are had nowadays, need to be treated as public utilities, and not, you know, subjected to the whims of some organization like the ADL or even Elon Musk for that matter, because as we've seen, he is not the free speech absolutist that he once claimed to be.
Exactly right.
All right. Well, Dr. Barrett, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it. Keep up the great work at American Free Press and on your own platform. I will have a link over to your Substack. I follow your work there, and I also follow you on Twitter, although, as we mentioned, we're probably likely shadow banned on Twitter, but it's still a good place to go to see what you're doing.
Okay, well, thanks, John. Always good talking with you.
Okay, thank you, sir. Have a happy Thanksgiving. I'll talk to you later.
Okay, you too.
Bye.
Bye.